Hello and welcome to Evolve with Bronwyn. I'm your host, Bronwyn Eisen. I'm grateful and blessed to introduce and highlight successful entrepreneurs whose gateway to success is attributed to health, wellness, and their faith. It's my passion to share their real stories and their entrepreneurial journeys. You can expect to laugh, cry, be educated, and be inspired by entrepreneurs who have persevered and experienced the highs and lows of working for themselves. You'll be inspired by how they've been able to obtain their personal and professional success through their courageous stories. I'm super excited to introduce to you my next guest. We met several years ago, and we've maintained an awesome friendship over the years. I'm a sports lover at heart, and I have such a respect for professional athletes and their dedication that they give to their sport. But furthermore, how a professional athlete can contribute and utilize their platform to help a community and the world if they have a passion to serve. My guest and friend is a former American football place kicker for the New England Patriots, Kansas City Chiefs, and the New York Jets. He was selected to the Pro Bowl 3 times, and when he retired, was ranked first in field goal percentage and also had the most field goals in NFL history. He is currently 10th on the National Football League's list of all-time scoring leaders and is the Chiefs' all-time leading scorer with 1,466 points in his 14 seasons with the club. He was known as the most accurate kicker in NFL history and was inducted into the Kansas City Chiefs Hall of Fame. He worked for 3 U.S. presidents in the White House during his NFL career and was the first pro athlete with a master's and fellowship from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. He is the winner of the most prestigious humanitarian award an NFL player can receive, the Byron Witzer White Award. So who is this wonderful friend of mine? Please welcome Mr. Nick Lowry, also known as Nick the Kick. But before we begin, if his NFL career wasn't enough, in 1996, Nick the Kick created the Nick Lowry Youth Foundation, which dedicates itself to helping disadvantaged youth, especially Native Americans, by developing, promoting, and sponsoring programs and relationships that foster self-esteem, leadership qualities and skills, and encourage youth to be positive assets in their community. Here to share with us about his career in the NFL and his youth foundation, my friend, Mr. Nick Lowry. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be on, and anybody that's not listened to Bronwyn before, it's an important addition in your life. So this will be the first of many, I'm telling you right now.
See, he's already inspiring everybody, so this is so awesome. Okay, Nick, so your career is absolutely outstanding, far beyond impressive. So I want the listener to get to know you a little bit more. I want to go to your roots. So where were you born? Where'd you grow up?
Well, you know, I'm just completely, I guess the right word is spoiled, not in terms of being part of a billionaire family, but I just a wonderful, unique background because my mother was in the first class of women at Oxford University. And back then, I think you'll relate to this, women were always held to a higher standard. So women at Oxford in the 1930s had to be honor students. Mm-hmm. So my mother was an honor student in Hochdeutsch, and so she ended up being literally speaking the best German of anyone in England. During World War II, particularly at the end, she was a first in her intelligence class of officers in the Women's Royal Navy, or the WRENs, in England. And she grew up in Cairo, Egypt. And my father was in the first group of Fulbright scholars after the war. And my mother was helping run the Fulbright Scholars Program, which was an exchange of the best of the British and American scholars, so that as we would be leading the free world in a post-Hitler world, kind of important concept. And they met, and just a few months later were engaged and married, and my twin brothers, older brothers, were born in England. And I, 4.5 years later, was born in Munich, Germany. My dad, after completing Fulbright Scholars, working with Arnold Toynbee, who many people, probably a majority, would say was the greatest historian of the 20th century, literally, who wrote a tiny little 3-million-word series of 14 volumes called A Study of History from 1932 to 1962. He was in that group of Oppenheimers and Einsteins, et cetera, that were just people that were fundamental to how we looked at ourselves in the mid-1900s, post-World War II Europe in particular. My father actually was going to be on the cover of Life magazine as a prototype of Fulbright scholar, literally the week the Korean War broke out. But my dad was very senior CIA. And I found out that not only was my father senior CIA, but when he passed away literally almost exactly 10 years ago at his memorial service, I said, I know my dad's senior, but and they interrupted me, two of his former colleagues who had since retired, and they said, your dad wasn't senior, your dad was chief of station in London. So literally in 1965, 66, and 67, when we were living in London, the height of the early Sean Connery, James Bond years, really, right? James Bond was reporting to M, who represented the head of MI5 and MI6. And guess who was the head of the American equivalent MI5 and MI6? My dad. So I like to, I'm not really fantasizing when I say my father was, you know, in his own way, not James Bond, but the American M in London. And that's where I grew up. So I had a combination of living in England and Germany growing up when I was 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. And then when I was a baby for a year, and the rest was in Washington, in McLean, Virginia, which is where the CIA, as you probably know, it's called Langley, Virginia, but it's McLean, Virginia, Langley, where the CIA is located. We lived about 3 miles from the CIA.
Okay. So then, Nick, how is it that you got into football? Did you start playing as a little boy? I mean, because that's a completely different background than I ever even knew about you, actually.
Well, actually, England won the World Cup in 1966. I was playing soccer 10 hours a day. And I went to one of the oldest schools in England, St. Paul's School. And that's why I say, you know, my dad had a master's degree from Stanford. My mother was Oxford educated and just really was very lucky to go to great schools and learn to play soccer and then to play rugby 1 month a year in London. That's when I knew I could kick. But we went then to Germany, where all I did was play basketball and baseball. So it really wasn't until eighth grade that I started to kick. But here's another really serendipitous thing. I mean, how many people can say in their lives, Bronwyn, that they grew up, A, next door to one of John F. Kennedy's best friends, Justice Byron Whizzer White, who was a Supreme Court Justice after being number two under Bobby Kennedy at the Justice Department. And before that, he'd had a horrible career in the National Football League, leading the NFL in rushing 2 times in 3 years, one with the Pittsburgh Steelers and secondly with the Detroit Lions, finishing number one at Yale Law School the same year he led the National Football League in rushing. Wow. That was my next-door neighbor, Byron Whizzer White, on 6801 Hampshire Road. We were 6803 Hampshire Road next door. And literally the second day that we were there, the very first morning after we moved in, there was Bobby Kennedy with his really bright red hair. I think people don't talk about that as much. He really did, with his dog in the front yard, talking to Byron White, and his dog, by the way, peed on the side of our Buick station wagon, which, of course, I considered a badge of honor. And then, you know, to have that as a role model embodied not only academic excellence, but, of course, athletic excellence. So I think it's worth mentioning that, because I think it helped me think that there's a possibility, even though no one from my high school had ever played professional football from St. Albans School in Washington, D.C.,
Did you realize at that point in your life that your world was different than a lot of other people's? Because that is not a typical, like, childhood.
I spent a lot of time working with kids in development, and I started to do work actually working with, if you might say, adult kids in prison. I just started to do a couple things in Lansing Prison. And I'm very interested in how people develop in the brain itself, and that link between, as the kicker in the NFL, managing my emotions on the sidelines under great pressure. But, you know, all of us are sculpted emotionally, spiritually, through the intense moments in life in particular. I think learning to kick really made a huge difference for me.
Right. So you knew through playing soccer and rugby that you could kick. So
I knew I could kick.
Okay. So you knew you could kick. So then at that point, were you like, okay, you know what? I think I could pursue this as a career. Like, I'm good at this. I mean, at what point did you think, gosh, I'm a good kicker?
I knew I had the possibility of doing it. And that's why I applied just to Ivy League schools. I'd actually kicked the game-winning field goal. It's now become sort of a legendary kick in St. Albans history. The last literally second of my high school career in the mud and the rain against arch rival Landon. They were running on the field thinking they won 7-6, and I kicked a 40-something yard field goal to beat them. Literally, the ball went through after the gun went off. And so I knew I had a possibility of making it. But as a kicker, you know, it either goes through or it doesn't. So I got into Princeton and Dartmouth, went to Dartmouth College. It was extremely difficult to make it in the National Football League. Did not know I'd make it. So I was a drama major my first 2 years, switched to government in the post-Watergate era. I thought that would be a good thing to do. And was a legislative aide for Senator John Chafee of Rhode Island, who is a wonderful environmental senator, who co-authored the Clean Air and Clean Water Act and created the number one environmentalist on Capitol Hill. A wonderful man who literally was a true Korean War hero, featured in a number of history books. So I did not know I was going to make it. And my story, what I try to share with others is, what's great is, if you understand deep in your bones that persistence is the great equalizer, and you stick with it and stick with it, it's part of what I'm really focused on now in my life, which is the law of attraction, that you make your values congruent. Persistence becomes even easier when you're clear about who you are, what you care about, and you stick with it. So I was sticking with getting cut and rejected in tryouts and actually playing with teams 11 times, 8 different teams. But I knew that I might not make it. So I was a legislative aide coming out of college and also as an intern before my senior year for Senator Chafee, and then got a permanent job after the second year of rejections. I thought it was time to get serious and had a chance to be one of the only non-attorneys on the staff of the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee, working for Senator Bob Packwood of Oregon, who was the senior minority. He was what I would describe as a moderate Republican, something that doesn't seem to exist anymore, which is Senator Chafee and Senator Packwood were the kind of Republicans understood that while they were loyal to their party, they had to be loyal to their constituents and solve problems and work with Democrats to make it work. And of course, we're in a very sad era now where Republicans and Democrats have no clue about how to do that, and they're slaves to their individual parties. So I'm very passionate as I look at that, you know, who are the true problem solvers? And I was lucky to have that job. And literally, Bronwyn, I was starting in that job and I got a call from Jim Schaaf, who was the general manager for the Kansas City Chiefs. And I literally said thanks, but no thanks, hung up on him, and then thought I didn't hear what they had to say. And talked to my mentors, a man named Dick Johnson, who'd always been, if we're lucky to have those people that help us think through the big decisions in life. And he said, you better find him, because you'll always wonder if you don't what they had to offer. And so I traced him back to his hospital room, a guy I didn't know, didn't have his phone number, didn't know how to spell his name, James Shaw, but I found him. And that kind of blew him away. And we talked. They flew me in the next week. They gave me a big old $2,500 bonus, which today would have been, you know, $100,000. And but that was just enough for me to try one more time. And the reason I say that is, getting back to that theme of persistence, mm-hmm. I was not ready when I played 2 games with the New England Patriots in 1978. And we won both games and they cut me. One was a national TV game. I was not ready mentally, physically. But by sticking with it, I got mentally tougher, I got physically tougher. And then no one, including myself, probably 2 years earlier, for sure, was able to beat out the greatest kicker in the history of the National Football League at that point, John Stenerud, who'd been my idol, head-to-head every day, every kick, how fast the ball was kicked, how far it was kicked from, every single day, beat out him, who became the first kicker in the Hall of Fame. So my point is, if we think something's important to us, something that's connected to our purpose, and we stick with it for a week or a month, that's great. But in 2 years, you can become incredibly better, whatever it is that is your passion, and you can go from being a novice to being, you know, world class. And I really am convinced that if I'd made it and stayed with the Patriots and not gone through all those rejections and not had to learn about persistence and focus, and passion and hard work, and loving the process of getting better, then I would have had an average career. But instead, I went on to play 18 years and was the most accurate kicker in NFL history. And, you know, so those were all blessings. Everyone, when you're going through it, you don't see it that way. But every single bit of adversity teaches us, if we allow it to, how to work harder, how to be more focused, to be more passionate, and to love the work. And if you can learn to love the work, then the games themselves are a joy.
I think it's all, too, you know, persistence. But I like to also translate that as not losing our momentum, you know, just keeping the momentum and keeping your eye on that prize. And, you know, I have two daughters, and that's the one thing that I keep telling them. I mean, one wants to be an actor and the other one wants to be a makeup artist. I said, if that's what you want to be, don't lose sight of it. Just keep your momentum. So it's such a great message. And I mean, you've been doing it forever. I mean,
well, thank you. You know, and the interesting thing is, it's, to me, it's like climbing a tree of destiny. If you don't start, you know, they have the famous quote, Lao Tzu, a journey of 10,000 miles starts with one step. Well, imagine a 10,000 branch tree. And you step on one, and because you're on the first branch, you can see a higher branch than you could before. Each of those steps allows you to see more choices, more options, so you can adjust and grow as you move up that branch. So when I made it, I noticed new things and new distinctions that I didn't notice before. And that's why I like to say that by walking through and sticking with each opportunity, you move up a branch at a time. So suddenly, after making it, I felt much more clear how blessed this opportunity was, not just to make it. That's all you think about. How am I going to make it? To, wow, you have an opportunity now to sort of blend that sense of service, you know, which I'd gotten from a dad who couldn't talk about his career. And is there anything more fundamental than a father or mother's ability to talk to their child about their career and their values and their craft? And yet my parents have given that up. And so here I had the chance to use this part of my life as a professional athlete on the stage to use that notion of service, community service. My father's sister had cerebral palsy, started a program called Kick the Nick for Cerebral Palsy, and just loved it, loved the idea and the emotional weight of witnessing people with cerebral palsy, children, that literally had victories as simple as being able to tie their shoes and yet found a way to be happy, found a way to be overcomers every day of their lives. So that was a new stage for me, and that began another part of sort of multidimensional experience with the NFL, which was to be the best as a player, but also to make that contribution, celebrate that success as you go. So you ask about my career. To me now, where I am today is simply employing all those lessons about service and about contribution to make the transition away from being the greatest kicker in the history of the game, which I was when I retired, to hopefully, you know, making an equal contribution off the field. That's what I love about my life now, is all those skill sets, which were in their early stages many years ago, continue to grow. And that's what I'd like to share with your audience.
Yeah, and you're such a big influence and supporter with your Nick Lowry Youth Foundation, which we'll go into in just a couple minutes, because what you're doing is incredible. Before we jump into that, though, you have been around a caliber of people that is really remarkable, and you've certainly been blessed. So who would you say has been one of your biggest influences and supporters for you in your life?
Well, Lamar Hunt, the owner for the Chiefs, who founded the American Football League, and the name on the trophy to win the AFC is called the Lamar Hunt Trophy. He was a very wealthy man, a great entrepreneur, but he had such great humility and such great humanity. So that's one. Dick Johnson, the one I mentioned earlier, my mentor, from high school all the way to my 10th year in the league, always had this rich sense that God was in the room, that every single thing I was doing, I can feel some emotion coming out now, was going to affect me the rest of my life. Understanding every decision you make has consequences, and also that you have a perfect opportunity to celebrate your success while you're going through it, not afterward. So Dick Johnson helped me just say, never give up, that a man is measured not by how many times he falls down, how many times he gets up, each time you're stronger, wiser, and you know you're not going to give up on your dreams. Biggest, I think, shock to anyone listening is the fear of failure, but also the fear of success. It's frightening. If I don't make this kick and they cut me, does that mean I'll never make it in the NFL? That's how I was at the beginning. And then when they cut me, when the New York Jets cut me, a few days later, I'm like, well, they don't know what's inside me. And how on earth am I going to get used to running on the field, not knowing when I was going to have to kick a field goal, running on with a clock ticking down, 40, 30 seconds, 20 seconds, 15 seconds, picking out my target and kicking a ball in 1.27 seconds through a tiny little target in front of 50, 60, 80,000 people. There's only one way to learn that. You know, and what does a kicker learn from that? Number one, how to focus, how to block out the 11 very large, very physical people 20 feet away who want to block your kick and rip your head off. How to not pay attention to 20,000 people within earshot yelling obscenities at you and very special things about your mama. It teaches you how to focus in practice. That's a big thing to me. When you're an athlete, but also as in whatever your craft is, if you understand that practicing your craft is your craft.
But the biggest pressures and biggest challenges that you had was maybe more from the audience?
You know, I don't know about that, but it certainly is something you have to get used to. You have to work through. I mean, if you have to get through the juvenile notion that everybody's going to like me. I mean, even on your own team, even in your own town, no matter how good you are, there'll always be some people that think, you know, you're not good enough. You know, here I was, I became the most accurate kicker. I got a personal note from Lamar Hunt himself, said, you made your 100th field goal. That means you qualify 100 out of 131 as the most accurate kicker in NFL history. And yet there were people that thought, well, so what? You know, they'd still held on to Jan Stenner, whose career was, I think, 67%. Mine was 80%, you know. But those lessons help you deal with defining for yourself who you are, what real success is. And to me, real success, you begin to become much more clear about, is always empty. You don't include in those goals how you share it with your loved ones, how you share it with your friends, how you share it with your community. That's where, instead of a vacancy at the top of that mountain, cleared all the way up to, you know, Kilimanjaro of your life, Mount Everest, and you're alone on the top, or you get to the top and now your whole family's there. And I learned that when I kicked the game-winning field goal in the Pro Bowl in Hawaii, as beautiful as Hawaii is, with all the wonderful Hawaiian flowers, cameras in the locker room, and 17 Hall of Famers there, and, you know, Jack Lambert, and Dan Fouts, and John Hanna, and Ted Hendricks, and all these legends, Earl Campbell. And yet, as soon as everybody left the locker room, and I'd kicked the game-winning field goal, and I'd been on 60 Minutes, and I'd been on 20-20, and all these things that are, you know, ego-based, and certainly measurements or signposts, you're achieving some success, it felt so soulfully empty in that locker room. And it took me till the next day, as I was having dinner with one friend, I brought my friend, teammate Bob Grupp, who was our punter, that I hadn't brought my family and I hadn't brought my friends. And that was a seminal moment, because I said, I know now if I ever make it again, I'm going to. I was all pro seven times, but I'm going to, every time I make it now in Hawaii, I'm bringing everybody. So I have rich memories of two more game-winning field goals where mom and dad had dinner with me the night before the game, dinner with me after the game, and were sitting in the front row watching me do that. And that's where the richness is. Don't do that. You are in great danger of waking up when you're 40 and 50 and 60, having done great things, having been successful in your career, but feeling a huge vacancy in your soul because there's no one there to share it with.
Yeah, and that's probably a message that you're sharing with the youth, the Nick Lauer Youth Foundation. I'm trying to think when you were out here last. I think it's probably been a few, 3-4 years. And I'll share a quick story. Nick was so amazing to come over to Desert Christian Academy, which is where my daughters were going to school at the time. And I contacted the office and we had a football game that night. And I said, oh my gosh, I said, do you think that we could invite Nick Lowry to come and just speak to the boys before they start their game and have prayer time? And they were like, oh my gosh, heck yeah. So that was a really awesome night. And I thank you again for not only making a memory for myself and my daughters, but I know you made an impact that evening on everybody, not just the players, but the coaches, the audience, everyone who is staff at that school. It was a really special night.
What, will you do me a favor? Tell me what you feel, because I remember that vividly. I remember that game. I remember being on the sidelines. And let me just say, not every school and not every head coach would be comfortable. You know, I know a lot of pro athletes here who are, you know, have had great careers, and high school coaches have, more often than I'd like to admit, have been so intimidated or uncomfortable or let their ego get in the way. And yet at your Christian school, and your coach was fine with that, was not threatened. And here I could, you know, share something with them. And, you know, even if it's one distinction, you know, I think there's a romanticization, certainly, of the athlete today. And it's a lot of ego and narcissism in this, and money in the sports culture. And all too often we find out that an athlete, not as badly, nearly as badly as it appears, frankly, but still, that we hear that an athlete has run afoul of the law, or, you know, not manage their success. And the other side of it is, you may be successful, but you may not be happy unless you've done that homework. That homework is the kind of homework you do every day of your life. Good parent knows it. Good mother knows that. There's a thanklessness to it, but there's also a richness to it, knowing that you are being a mirror to someone and being an example to them, that past words, you know, will have its effect, even if right now it doesn't appear that way. Long term, they'll know by the way you acted, more than what you said, what is the right thing to do.
Yeah, well, it was just a blessing to have you there that night. And I know that it was an unforgettable evening for everybody there. So it was magical for me. And I, you know, just wanted to share that with you, that I still, to this day, I'm so grateful that you took the time out of your life to come over and spend the time. So as you're speaking to the youth of America, oh my goodness, things are changing. I'm raising two teenage daughters. I mean, what are you seeing with our youth today that you think they're struggling with the most?
You know, I'll give you something that's pretty current. My agent was a guy named Lee Steinberg, and he's now, after some serious drinking issues, which he doesn't hide, he's been sober for 8 years, and he's resurrected his career because he represented the very best in football. He was the one that was the consultant for the movie with Tom Cruise and Jerry Maguire. He represented Steve Young and Warren Moon and Troy Aikman and all these great quarterbacks. And now he represents the greatest quarterback in the National Football League, Patrick Mahomes, with my Kansas City Chiefs. And Patrick was asked to speak to the Texas A&M team, the same team that's playing tonight for the championship. And I loved what he said, because to me it was so perfect, which is, A, you've got to earn it. You've got to earn it. And no one will give anything to you. Today's generation have been given trophies for finishing last. They have been coddled too much because no one wants to hurt their self-esteem. And I get the other side of that with bullying, you know, that you, every young person deserves to feel that they're special and important in life. But having said that, nothing's going to be given to you. And as hard as it is for so many parents, and I'm sure it would be hard for me too, to not give their child everything that they can, the best lesson is that the things that really matter, you love working for, and you have to struggle for, and you have to not assume, because so many kids growing up in Scottsdale, you know, they have as many emotional issues, whether they're rich or whether they're poor. On the rich side in Scottsdale, you know, the 16-year-old daughters that beg their dad for a boob job are upset because they have a 2014 BMW rather than a new one, you know, at the age of 16, 17. What does that teach them about working and creating something for themselves and having the skill sets to not just inherit something that's material, but more importantly, to inherit a spiritual, character-based skill set that will allow them to deal with and confront and embrace every single kind of adversity, which we know never stops. And from a biblical point of view, God didn't promise us a lack of adversity. It's simply that he would be there to support us as we run our race.
Yeah, 100%. And these are lessons that I share with my daughters. very interesting raising teenagers for sure, and some of their friends, and they have friends that are in, you know, every economic status. So some that whose parents have more money than, you know, her other friends whose parents, you know, don't have as much. And, you know, her first year in theater, she was disappointed that she had one line in the play. I said, you got to earn it. Like, you're not going to get the lead role the first time, you know. And she worked her butt off the whole year, and she did really well. Next year, she got the lead. But she knew that she had to go and she had to earn it. And so that is such a great message, Nick. And you know, it's about the journey. I mean, how can you even appreciate anything without the journey when everything's just handed to you?
And you don't just earn it at the event. You know, you don't just earn it in the championship game. You earn it through the work when no one's watching. You earn it when I like to talk about what I had to do, which was learn to not only see myself and imagine myself in the game visually, right? Mm-hmm. Running on the field, kicking the game, winning field goal, and situations so that I rehearsed it, but rehearsing the confidence, rehearsing and projecting that sense so vividly of those moments of acute getting it done or not, that when I went out there, it felt like my own birthday party. That's the hard work you have to do. And so I'd get in this zone training, you know, working with pants that I could put weights in so I could run sprints, and doing lunges with 240 pounds, and doing incline squat, sled squats, 800-pound sets of 15. Those were things I could not have done when I was, you know, 24, early in my career. But I built up and built up and built up. I found that ballet, martial arts, all those things helped. That work was cumulative, and when you love that, you start noticing how much more confident you are, because it's almost like the game's playing while you're working out. And that's what's great about it, is you stick with it so much that each of those games comes back to you and builds that greater sense of transcendence over your craft. But you earn it every day. You never take it for granted. So that perhaps is the biggest lesson of all in anything. Not take anything for granted, to stay humble, to stay hungry.
Yeah, those are some good little nuggets for sure for our youth. And I know you're speaking, all over the United States, and you're right there in Scottsdale, Arizona, which the next time I come out, I'm definitely going to make sure that we get together.
Sounds good.
Okay, Nick, you're awesome. I love what you're doing with the youth. I know that you have great things that you're working on.
Now that we're wrapping up, Nick, what is it that you're doing now?
Well, what I'm doing now is working with Canon Life Sciences because what we've worried about with football is the concussion issue. So I want to give parents good news and bad news. The bad news is that, you know, it was always there, that blows to the head, not just even soccer blows. Girls that play soccer, girls are at least twice as susceptible to concussions. What we're finding is that it's not just the concussions, it's the small repetitive hits. You know, so if you think of the analogy of a 10, 50 mile an hour car crash versus a 50 mile an hour car crash, the accumulation of those little headers, or in the case of football, those practice hits, helmet to helmet, add up too. The bad news is that, you know, that really does have literally an impact on the brain. The good news is we're learning from the Salk Institute, Dr. David Schubert, from UCLA Torrance in 2014, from Stanford University in 2014-2017, the University of Bonn in Jerusalem, that there are tremendous benefits to creating what we call an inner cellular helmet. The outside helmet, if you saw the movie Concussion, can only do so much, and they're getting better. But I'm passionate that we can create a daily, if you will, the equivalent of a multivitamin based out of CBDs, not marijuana, not necessarily even hemp, which is now legal, passed by Congress and signed by the president in December, but something that literally UCLA Torrance suggests it makes the brain, the cells or the neurons in the brain, literally five times more resilient and robust and able to maintain their definition, not be damaged by impacts. So those are important things, not just in football, but for cheerleaders, really, it's just something I think that should become a daily vitamin if in its own way, or intercellular helmet. And I want anybody that's interested in learning more, you could read about Canna Life. There's a nice piece on Dateline NBC. If you just put in Dateline and Canna Life, K-A-N-N-A-L-I-F-E, about what we're learning. And that's really important. The brain is the epicenter of all our decisions and how we manage ourselves.
You know, I'll get the information from you and make sure that everybody is able to take a look at what you're talking about. And that really segues into the health and wellness aspect of this podcast. So that's very interesting. I probably want to talk to you again about that, Nick.
You got it.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I'm very grateful today that you've been on the show. So thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Bless you.
Bless you too, Nick. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining me here at Evolve with Bronwyn. My wish and hope for you is that you were inspired and moved by my guest today. I'm grateful to share these stories, as my goal for you is that you evolve and recognize that you have what it takes to achieve your personal and professional greatness just as much as anyone else. Until next time, blessings to you.